So tonight we're going to look at the parsha of Shelach, which is one of the most central stories in the Torah, in the Chumash. It's one which really has, I guess, eternal significance in terms of the history of the Jewish people. So let's maybe start by going over a basic outline of the story. We'll then look at some parts of the story more in depth, and then try to understand them a little bit. So, based on where we are in the parsha, I know some of you have been calling intuition parsha classes, others haven't, but based on where we are in terms of the overarching story. So, if we look at the story, let's leave aside for a sheet. So we had the story of slavery in Egypt, then the story of the leaving of Egypt, and then there was coming to Mount Sinai to receive the Torah. That's the process we're in the middle of. What was the end goal which that process was leading up to? What was the end goal which this whole process was trying to culminate in? Does anyone have any idea?
Coming to the land of Israel.
Exactly. Coming to the land of Israel. And that's something which already from the beginning, to the promise to Abraham was they would inherit the land. And Moshe has been talking about from the beginning, coming to the land of Israel. And in this week's parsha, that's where they are. They were at Mount Sinai. There was the sin of the golden calf, so there was a setback. They had to spend a long time at Mount Sinai. They had to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle. And now finally, they gathered the camp. They had the count. They figured out who goes where. Everything's set up, and they're ready to go to the land of Israel. And that's exactly where we are in this week's parsha, which in that sense really should have been the end of the Torah. The Torah should have ended here, and that's it. So something obviously went wrong, and that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. So we come to this parsha at the point where they're ready to enter the land of Israel. And they're on the southern border of the land of Israel, in a place called Kadesh Barnea. It's what currently is the Negev, the desert, which is southern Israel currently, wasn't technically part of Israel. Then it was really uninhabited. And they're on the border. And the people say, you know what? We don't really want to go in. We want to send spies, you know, check out the place, see if it's actually as good as it's promised, see if we could win, make a plan. Not totally clear what the goal of the spies was, also not totally clear whose idea were the spies. We'll look at that maybe a little bit later. Who wanted the spies? Was it coming from the people? Was it coming from God? Was it coming from Moses? Where was that coming from? So they send the spies, and ultimately the sending of the spies was a complete disaster. The spies come back, say, this is hopeless, forget about it, we're not doing it, we can't get to the land of Israel. The Jewish people go along with that, say, we can't do it. And then Moses prays, so the people aren't destroyed, but they're punished with 40 years in the desert. When we think of the 40 years in the desert, that's something which happened as a result of the sin of the spies that wasn't part of the original plan of the Exodus. The original plan was they would come out of Egypt, they would go to Mount Sinai. A few months later, they would go. It's only a couple of days' journey to travel through the desert from Egypt to Israel. You know, you could do it, you know, without taking too much time. Continue on, go to the land of Israel, everything would be great. And because of that sin, the Jews were delayed 40 years in the desert. Not only that, so the same sin of the spies is something which reverberates through the generations. In a few weeks, we're going to be not sure what the right word is, not celebrating, it's, I guess, recognizing, observing the day of Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which is the day of tragedy in the Jewish year. So does anyone know what that primarily commemorates, what happened on that day of tragedy?
Both of the temples fell.
Exactly, both of the temples were destroyed. And a number of other things, tragedies happened as well. What was the first tragedy which happened on that day? Does anyone want to take a guess?
The spies gave a bad report.
Exactly. Exactly, Dan. So the spies gave a bad report, and the rabbis say that fact that the spies gave the bad report and the people cried, they cried saying, we can't do it, we're not going to be able to conquer the land, let's go back to Egypt, that mistake of the people led to, when they came into the land of Israel, that there were problems, and ultimately culminated in the destruction of the first temple and then the second temple. So that sin is a turning point in Jewish history, which sets up the tragedies for the Jewish people throughout history. So it's a sin which isn't just something relevant to what were those crazy people doing, you know, 3,000 years ago in the desert. It's something which would seem to be of relevance, of significance for us as well. And that's going to be something you have to understand. How is their sin something which was so central, and how is it something which is something we fall into, whether in the same form or whether in alternate forms nowadays? Okay, so that's setting up the framework for the story and the centrality of the story of the spies. So maybe let's, right now, have a look at the story itself, and then we'll continue from there to try to understand what was the sin. Okay? So let's see if I can figure out how I can give you the verses. Give me 1 second. Okay. So I think you all should now be able to see, I have in the Word document open the verses from the parasha. Okay, so give me 1 second. All right, so let's start with the mission. So like we said, Moses sends them on the mission to spy out the land. You know, the people were involved in it. There's a parallel story. Like many others, there's a parallel story in the book of Devarim, which we might look at a little bit later. Right now we're looking at the primary story, not the review at the end of the 40 years when Moshe gives the flashback in a retelling of the story. And the retelling is a little bit different, but that's not our topic tonight. So we're going to look at the way it's framed over here with Moshe's, with the mission he gives them. Elise, do you want to read the verses of the spies' mission, what Moshe tells them they're supposed to do?
Sure. The spies' mission. 13:18. See what kinds of land it is. Are the people who live there strong or weak, few or many? Is the inhabited area good or bad? Are the cities where they live open or fortified? Is the soil rich or weak? Does the land have trees or not? Make a special effort to bring back some of the land's fruits.
Okay, great. So if you had to summarize, what's the objective? What are they spying for? What are they trying to find out?
I'm sorry, are you asking me or anybody?
Go ahead.
I mean, they really just want to get a feel. Is this a safe place? Is this a place where we're going to survive? You know, what are the people like there? Are they going to accept us? Are we going to be safe? Are we going to be able to live off the land there and have what we need?
Okay, great. So there's two different, it seems like there's two different things. One is finding out about the people, and two is finding out if it's going to be providing them what they need. One factual question, which is, what's the plan for the people who live there? I mean, if they're asking if the cities are open or fortified, is the plan to live with the people there or to conquer the people there?
Oh, conquer the people.
Right, so the plan is actually conquest, and therefore the question is, can we win? Meaning the land has people there. Are we going to be able to win that war? Are they strong or are they weak? What kind of military situation are they in? Okay, great. So that's what they are supposed to do. So then they go, and I skip the verses from 20 to 27 that describes geographically how they travel. Jessica, do you want to pick up from 13:27? So what did they come back and say?
The following report. We came to the land where you sent us, and it is indeed flowing with milk and honey, as you can see from its fruit. However, in the lands are aggressive, and the cities are large and well fortified. We also saw the giants' descendants there. Amalek lives the Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hills, and the Canaanites live near the sea and on the banks of Jordan. For Moses, we must go forth and occupy the lands, he said. Oh, it just got moved.
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I hit the wrong button. I apologize.
It's okay. Wait, where was I? Oh, he said, we can do it. Go forward against those people, replied the man who had gone with him. They are too strong for us. They began to speak badly about the land that they had explored. They crossed to explore the land that consumes its inhabitants. All the men we saw were huge. While we were there, we saw the Titans. They were sons of the giant who descended from the original Titans. We felt like tiny grasshoppers. That's all we were. Should I keep going?
No, that's a good place to stop. Okay, so, so that's the basic outline of their report. Suzanne, do you want to try to summarize what their report was, what the various aspects of the report were?
They were saying that, yes, it's got, you know, it would have what we need, but the people there are, we can't go there because the people are giant and they'll squish us. And they, I don't think it says they brought back, allegedly, didn't they bring back like giant fruit?
Absolutely right. So they brought back fruit, which was large. It describes in the previous one, they brought back an entire vine of grapes, which was carried on a staff by two people. So they're bringing back fruit, which is showing an abundant growth in the land. But let's just take that for a minute, because it's important in understanding just the meaning of the story. So when you're picturing that, so you're picturing like a giant fruit, which is, you know, almost like a fairy tale. You know, you mentioned giants when they talk about titans. So what do they mean that these people are giants, they're titans? Anyone have any thoughts what they're describing?
That they wouldn't be able to conquer them and overtake them.
Great. So what do they mean they're giants? You know, we're talking 50 feet tall, 100 feet tall. You know, what exactly are we talking about? What about titans? Like, titans seem to exist, you know, in the movies and the myths. What are they talking about here when they're calling them titans?
Like, very strong people?
Very strong people, exactly. But meaning, when they talk about the large fruits, or they talk about titans, or they talk about grasshoppers, we should be viewing this through the lens of hyperbole. Like, they're talking in terms of a perception. They're very strong. It's something which is impacting them in a certain way. For example, in Manhattan, right, they're very tall buildings. What do we call them?
Skyscrapers.
So does anyone actually think they're scraping the sky, they're touching the sky?
No.
No, it's hyperbole, and that's the way that's spoken about. Or similarly, when we talk about the shot heard around the world, there are certain things we talk about in a way which sounds like it's mythic, it's outside of natural, normal events. And especially since we're so disconnected from the text, we can often project that kind of movie picture onto the story of the Bible, onto the story of the Torah. And we have to realize it's talking in human language, and human language includes things like hyperbole and, you know, the different perspectives of the participants. So when we're looking at this and we're thinking giants, we don't necessarily have to think, you know, movie-type giants of, you know, 50 feet tall or something like that, but it could have been just strong people who are giving the impression of being invincible. So that's the framework we should be thinking about these verses. Okay. So
I just have a question to clarify something.
Sure.
Is the sin of the spies, is that just the very act of scoping out the land and looking at the land, or is the sin the actual bad report itself? Like, you see the distinction between the two?
Yeah, so what do you think?
I think it's actually the bad report, what was the sin, and not the act of just scoping out the land.
Do you have any evidence for that?
Well, doesn't the parsha begin by Moshe basically assembling like the leaders of each tribe and telling them to go out and scope the land and then see? So it seems like they were ordered to scope out the land. So I don't think that could be like the sin, but them saying like bad things about the land, I think that's the issue here.
Exactly. But the sending itself was Moses, but he did it. Moshe did it. So what we're talking about is the report. Absolutely. Exactly.
Wait, so you're saying that Moshe shouldn't even have ordered the people to scope out the land to begin with?
That's an interesting question. That's, like I mentioned, there's a parallel description in the Book of Devarim, which, hold on, let me see if I have it. Yes, so let's see if I can share it. The screen differently. Do you see the current screen that I'm showing, or is it the same screen as before? Okay, so now I think I'm trying to share with you a different screen. Do you see it? It starts with 122. This is just a technical question. Can someone confirm that they're seeing on the screen something that says that starts at 122?
Yes.
Yes, okay, good. I just made sure the technology was okay. So this is the parallel account in Devarim. And over here, if you look at the first verse, it's describing it as the people came to Moses and said, we really want to have spies. And if you look at Moshe's retelling of the story, he's putting a lot more blame on the people. The people said, we want spies. The spies gave a better report, and the people were looking for a bad report. So, like many things, there are numerous perspectives, numerous levels of what's going on. So, while the sin technically was the report, and that's what we're going to focus on, it seems like that report was coming in the context of the spies, the leaders, going along with what the people want in a way which was inappropriate. Meaning the people were looking for a problem, the people were looking for a reason not to go into the land, and the spies, instead of being good leaders and resisting it, they were being, you know, leaders who lead from behind. Might have any of you had experience with that kind of thing? With that kind of mistake? Is that familiar with any of you? Danielle? Suzanne?
That the information... I'm sorry.
That even though the technical mistake was giving a bad report, and if they had given a good report, things would have been fine, but it wasn't something which was coming out of the blue. It was coming from the people were, in their original request to send spies, looking for a bad report so they could have an excuse not to go. And therefore, the spies, as leaders of the Jewish people, instead of leading, were following. You know, were giving the people what they wanted to hear. Right? They were political leaders who were telling the people what they wanted to hear instead of leading the people to what the people needed to hear.
I thought the sin was just not having faith in God. Like, God was saying, I'm sending you to Canaan, like, this is where you should be going, and by listening to this report and giving the report, they're just not having faith in him. Then they were punished for that. I thought it all had to do with the not having faith in Hashem.
Okay, so what would that look like to have faith in Hashem?
To enter the land and not have, you know, regardless of whether they had spies or not, to say, you know, this doesn't look good, but let's trust in Hashem that he wants us to go there. And then Caleb and Joshua were the only two out of the 12 who said, you know, it's going to be okay. Let's go.
I also believe that if maybe there was part of them that thought that, like, they would be able to go ahead and be successful in the land, but it would take a lot of work, and maybe they thought that their people were not capable of that.
Okay, so how would that, is that another point, or is that connecting to Elisa's point about having faith?
I believe it's another point.
Okay, so you're saying maybe... Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that they just weren't... that maybe they didn't have themselves enough faith that even if there was a part of them that thought that that they really could overcome the giants, that they didn't believe that the people as a whole would be able to be successful because they're conquering a people and then starting from scratch.
So it sounds like you're arguing, which is interesting, that faith in God and faith in ourselves are going to be linked to each other.
Yeah.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
No, that's all I had to say on that. I mean...
Right, so we have, that's a good point. So we have on the one hand, there's a lack of faith in themselves. Right? They don't think they could do it. But on the other hand, God promised them, like Elise said, and there's not a faith in God. So that's something, so there are these two themes, we have to figure out how they go together. Something else at least noticed, like Joshua and Caleb were both part of the spying mission. So physically, like they saw the exact same things the other 10 spies did. So how could they give exact opposite reports? Like you have two people seeing the exact same thing and yet their reports are two exact opposite type of ideas.
I mean, they, I mean, I know this is just sounds like such a simplistic answer, but I think they, I know I keep repeating myself, I just think they had more faith in Hashem. The so, people just relaying the information and they were listening, regardless of what the report was.
Okay, good. So let's maybe play that out a little bit. What exactly we mean by faith in Hashem? Because that seems to be the key concept, the key term that's being debated here, which is, can we have faith? Can we have conviction? Faith nowadays has certain connotations of a blind faith, but faith also has the sense of trustworthiness. So can we have faith or can we have conviction in Hashem? Or, no, these enemies are so powerful, we can't have conviction.
Well, there have been so many examples of how Hashem, he parted the Red Sea, he took them out of Egypt. It's as if, I did all this for you, and, now you're so close to where I'm sending you, and now you're just giving up. You just want to go back.
Right, they didn't learn the lesson from their whole trip all this time. Right. But there's an important change here, which is up till this point, everything's been miraculous. At this point, it seems like it's going to be shifting to them actually doing more, to them having to fight. Or at least attack, even if the enemy will retreat, will run away. So there are miracles, but it looks like the miracles are at least not going to be as trustworthy as something which is the focus point. So how can you transition that faith in the miracle to a faith when it's no longer the blatant extreme miracles of the leaving of Egypt?
Can you ask that again?
Yeah, meaning so they should have had faith from the leaving of Egypt, especially with all the miracles. And for those of you who were in last week's class, even when it comes to miracles, there is a lack of faith. But over here, it seems like they're being asked to do one step more, which is start transitioning that conviction in God. God will help them, not only in the miraculous, but even in the natural. So how can you compare? It's very nice God did miracles for our ancestors in Egypt, or in this case for us in Egypt, but how does that translate to being able to defeat these really strong people? But are the Canaanite giants, are the Canaanite warriors defeatable not through miracles, or is it relying on a miracle?
I believe what it's what I mentioned earlier about, and maybe it's not a miracle, but it's having enough faith that Hashem will give the people enough faith to get through whatever they have to get through in order to conquer the land and settle.
So it's faith in a certain meta principle, in a principle overarching that we don't yet know exactly how we'll do it, but if this is the command, there must be a method. That if we look hard enough, we'll figure it out.
I would say so.
So that's a very good idea. That's an interesting idea. So if you look, that's very much what Caleb and Joshua are saying. So if you look a little bit further down, not 14:8. Right, if God is satisfied with us and brings us to the land, he can give it to us, the land flowing with milk and honey. Right? That's exactly their argument. We don't know exactly how we'll do it, But insofar as we know there are opportunities, we know there are options in the world, if we're not seeing the opportunity here, then we need to reevaluate. So now let's try to take that idea and see the spies, what they should have done, like a number of you have been mentioning, Julie, Danielle, a few of others, they should have recognized God is giving us this opportunity. He's telling us we could do it. Therefore, we should have conviction in our ability and be searching for opportunity. And it seems that the spies, the other 10 spies, their mistake was not recognizing that. And their argument to the people will be in that domain. So let's now try to understand. So how were the spies trying to convince the people that we can't do it? Meaning, what was the difference concretely? Let's try to now concretize a little bit so that we could apply it outside of the one story of the spies as a general principle. What was the difference between the way the 10 spies were looking at it versus the way the 2 spies, Joshua and Caleb, were looking at it? So let's maybe hone in on one feature, and then we'll take it to some of the other ones. So let's note a few significant features of their story. So number one, right, the spies right away, what is the first thing the spies say?
They start off with something positive, and they agree that it is this land flowing with milk and honey.
Okay, good. So they're starting off with positive. Why do you think they're doing that? If they're giving a bad report, why are they starting off with the positive? Any thoughts? Anyone?
Well, when you usually evaluate something, it's usually too positive and then a negative.
What do you mean?
I mean, I'm just comparing it to, like, if you're doing evaluations for, like, human resources. It's not a great comparison, but it's usually you state the positives and then you go,
we
haven't
seen
any negatives.
So in human resources, so why do they state the positives first? Why don't just go straight to the negatives?
Because then you automatically bring people down instead of, like, lifting their spirits and then going through some of the setbacks.
Right, so in human resources, they're trying to make the person not feel bad.
Correct.
So, but over here, it's funny, because over here, then, we would expect the opposite, because the spies are trying to convince the people it's not worth it. The spies are trying to convince the people not to go into the land.
I'm sorry, I thought this was Joshua, and I'm looking at the wrong response. Sorry about that.
That's fine. Okay. That's the funny thing, is at the beginning, the spies sound like they could have been Joshua and Caleb. They sound like they're giving a good report. It's great. It's a great land. This is a great land. The whole thing is a wonderful land. Why, if they're giving a bad report, would they start with It's a good land?
Could it be that they're trying to say, look, we're not trying to sway you. I mean, it's great. It has fruit, milk, and honey. But these people we just can't. You know, we're not going to be able to fight these people. I think, could it be that they're trying to show that maybe that, you know, we're not biased. I don't know.
Go ahead. No, it's a good point. I like the point.
We're not biased. It's great if you want to get crushed when you get there. I mean, it has its benefits, but it's just not a safe neighborhood.
Right. I mean, it adds credibility. Like, you know, if you just say everything's bad, you're biased. You say, no, it's good, but it gives credibility to a slander. If you want to speak bad about something, you speak bad about something. One thing people often do is they'll start out with praise, which puts a framing to the real point, which is the negative.
So it's more persuasive.
If I see a few smiles, it seems like that's something people are familiar with. Is that something you have encountered in the world, in other cases, in human resources elsewhere?
I think they do this in real estate.
Interesting. And what? I'm not familiar with real estate. How do they do this in real estate?
I just meant when I've looked for apartments. You know, especially I think in New York, the neighborhood's not great, but you're close to the train. They sort of gloss over the apartment is the size of a cat litter box, but you're close to restaurants, you're close to this, so they really hype up what's good. I think people do this when they're trying to show they're not biased against another person. Would actually be a better example, like if your friend is dating somebody. No, I like him, but X, Y, and Z. So you're saying, I'm not biased, he's a nice person or she's a nice person, and then there are these qualities.
Definitely a good, both are good examples. One on the positive, meaning it's used both ways. So both are definitely good examples. And it's something which makes it more difficult because, we might not want to talk badly about people, but when you start hearing it and it's framed with this positive, it gives an excuse, it gives us an out to not really focus on the harm or the damage of what we're doing. So both the real estate and the friend example are both great examples. So that's good. So that's the first step. Does anyone want to give other examples or thoughts on that first step, where they see it elsewhere outside of this vice?
Well, another example is like in politics, political opponents will call their opponent like their friend, and then they'll attack the opponent.
Great example. Right? So in politics, you see this all the time. Many of the if we study, problems, politics, you'll often find them. So that's definitely a great example. So political, people. Excellent. So now let's move to the next step. So that was the first thing. They started with something good, which gives them credibility, which, feeds into what the people want to hear. The people are now going to be able to listen to them. So now let's look at the next step. So then, like we've mentioned, they have a shift. And they say basically they're too strong, and therefore, the cities are strong and the people are strong. Now, at this point, they're not yet saying anything about whether they could do it or not. Right? The next step, they're not saying whether we could do it or not. Their job is to give a report on the facts. And they give a report on the facts. These are the facts we saw. Now, the people, it seems like, are already starting to be bothered and taking the hint, but they're not being explicit yet. After that, Kalev steps up and tries to stop them. Says, no, we could do it. It's true they're strong, but we can do it. And now, the spies take their speech to the next level. So, in 1331... Right after giving, so first they said something good, then they said what the problems were, leaving it up to the interpretation of the people. Then when Kalev pushes back against them, they now go a step further. Right. So what's the next step? So the next step is when they make it explicit. Now they're actually going to start giving policy decisions. Right? They're moving out of the role of advisors, of spies. Go tell us the original mission. Go tell us what the facts are. And Moses, as the leader, would make the decisions. Now they're starting to give their opinion. What should actually be done based upon their reports. Now they're already starting to move outside of the immediate legitimacy of their job. And the next step is where it becomes even stranger, which is up till now we would think they have said bad things. But the Torah says no, now they began to speak badly. Up till now, is anything they said false? No, but everything is true. They were asked to judge the land. They judged it. They were asked to judge the people. They gave a report. Okay, they went a little bit beyond their mission. Now, once they see that they're not getting their way, they go a step further. They start making things up. They start saying bad things. So one thing here is specifically worth noting, which is it's a land that consumes its inhabitants. What does that mean, it consumes its inhabitants? Just factually, what do you think consuming its inhabitants would imply? Sean, any thoughts?
Like it kills its inhabitants?
Exactly. It's basically people are dying. We went there and we saw people dying. It's a land which kills people. Exactly. So, let's focus on that for a moment. They see people dying. They see the people are involved in, you know, in mourning and burial, etc. Right, so they're judging that as that means the land is bad. If you had to guess, how would Kalev or Joshua interpret that?
Repeat the question.
So they said the land is killing, you know, a lot of people are dying, and they're saying since we saw people dying, it must be the land is killing the people. It's a bad land which kills people, which was outright blatant falsehood, meaning the fact that you have people dying doesn't mean the land is killing them. But okay, so there was a lying aspect. But how would Joshua and Caleb interpret the fact that people are dying? Right? How should they have interpreted this? What other interpretation would it lend itself to? Or what other interpretations? They might be more than one.
That no one's been able to step up and fight against these people?
How would it mean that?
Well, if the other spies are saying that it's a place that consumes its inhabitants, then they're out to get everyone, or everyone who tries to live there, fight against the quote-unquote giants, dies. But Joshua and Caleb would probably have the foresight and the faith to say, hey, we can do it, let's go, this land is perfect for us, we can overtake everyone who's there.
So the people there are people, the inhabitants are the giants or other people? I'm just not sure how you're reading the verse.
The other people.
Other people. Okay, so you're saying there's two groups there. There's the giants who are killing everyone else, and therefore we aren't going to be able to fight also.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, I've taken it a little bit differently. It could be you're right. I was thinking it meant, you know, the giants are the inhabitants, and it means not only are there people there, the people just are dying. You know, the people are being buried, people are dying right and left, so it's a bad land. You're saying there's different groups of inhabitants. That definitely could be. That would be strengthening their main message. You know, meaning the people are huge and therefore it's killing inhabitants. Not sure why those would be inhabitants, but okay. I think the other interpretation is better, though, meaning that it's the inhabitants are the same people who they saw who were huge. So assuming that's the fact, so how would Joshua and Caleb interpret that fact? What would they say? The fact that many of the inhabitants, the giants, are dying, what does that tell us? Does that tell us the land is bad? Or could that be telling us something else?
Maybe they just don't know how to not conquer, but conquer the actual land to make it I mean, almost like a very literal interpretation. The giants could be bad and not worthy of God's... Ooh, that sounds bad. But they just may not be good people. Or they may not be able to... That sounds bad, too. They may not know how to, deal with the land to make it useful. That may sound kind of crazy, too. But.
No, that makes sense. I mean, one possible interpretation would be, it's true that people are dying, but it's because the land needs a certain way of living in it, and it's a problem of the relationship of the people to the land. It's not intrinsic to the land. That definitely would be an alternate interpretation where it's not bad, which again, the spies are going beyond what the facts of it demand. What other kind of interpretations would be there?
Was another idea that since the giants are also dying, that they're not so like immortal, like that they could be defeated in a fight?
Okay, good. Right, that would be another interpretation, meaning it's an opportunity. This isn't a disaster that people are dying. This is the opportunity. You wonder how we could do it. Well, if some of them are dying, they're not immortal, and maybe this is an opening. Right, so maybe it's that the people, you know, that it's not really so bad. Maybe it's an opening. But there are many other interpretations here. So when we're looking at the story, what the spies are doing is they're looking at the event with certain eyes. Whether it's that they should have looked at it as, you know, the people are dying because they don't have the right strategy, they're not close to God, or they don't know the strategy for the land. Whether it's the people are dying because that's how God's helping us. You know, I think Sean suggested that. Either way, there's different people looking at it from different standpoints could see the exact same events, the exact same facts, and give, you know, exact opposite or blatantly different interpretations. Let's do one more verse, which I think has a similar, which reflects a similar principle, and then maybe we'll try to develop that idea a little bit. So now let's come back to the next verse, which we saw earlier. Dan, do you want to just read it for us? Last 1333.
Okay. While we were there, we saw the Titans. They were sons of the giant who descended from the original Titans. We felt like tiny grasshoppers. That's all that we were in their eyes.
Okay, great. Right, so this is still the spy speaking. And it's still through that same lens, that same view of reality. Right. So I think now we could start answering one of the questions we mentioned at the beginning, which is, why are they using this hyperbole of the Titans? It sounds like, you know, these are creatures out of myth. So now, based on what we've been saying, why would they be using that kind of language?
Well, I think, again, it's just giving you that visual that we can't conquer them. You're picturing a tiny grasshopper and a big Titan, they're going to destroy us. It's not possible.
Right. This isn't describing the facts. This is describing how the spies felt. They felt to us like Titans. Exactly. Exactly what you're saying. Exactly, Elise. Right. And that's also, if you look at the end, that's all we were in their eyes. So did they ask the Titans, they're these giants, excuse me, what do we seem like to you? How do they know what the Canaanites were thinking about them? Julie, what do you think?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
So just to continue Elise's thought at the end. So it says, we felt like grasshoppers. Okay, that's their feelings. And that's all we were in their eyes, in the Canaanites' eyes. How do you know what the Canaanites are thinking?
They don't, but if you're trying to it says, we felt like tiny grasshoppers. That's all we were in their eyes. So, I mean, if you're trying to paint a picture of, like, not being powerful enough to overcome them, so you shouldn't go into the land, so so you can interpret it that way and when you're reporting.
Okay, good. Meaning, so why were they interpreting that way? So that was their motivation, was because they wanted to report something bad, they thought they couldn't do it. But why did they think that's what they were in the Canaanites' eyes?
Well, if they're viewing these Canaanites as being these, like, you know, strong individuals, then it's just a metaphor for saying that we're much smaller. You know, we, meaning the Jewish people, are much, much smaller.
Right, and therefore, of course, that's what they're thinking, right? If I'm scared of them, they must be feeling powerful over us. We project our own fears, our own view of the world, and assume the rest of the world views the world the way we do. Right? You know, I don't know if any of you, there's Dr. Seuss story, which is one of my son's favorites, about a pair of green pants. You know, it's an empty pair of green pants. The kid in the story is terrified of them. He sees them. He runs away. The end of the story, he finds out the pants are just afraid of him also, because there was this novelty, there was a fear going both ways. Meaning, but we, when we look at the world, we look at it through our own eyes, and we assume that our immediate feelings about the world actually tell us what the world is and how the other person is viewing it. It's very hard to enter the other person's, you know, look at it from how they would be feeling based on their background, based on their framework. So the spies, again, in part of their failure, their sin, was not just evaluating the facts, but allowing their, what's the opposite of rose-colored glasses? You know, when everything's bad. I'm not sure what you would call those, but you know, the negative perception clouded everything that they were seeing. So, does anyone have any thoughts on that, on that phenomenon? That also seems like it's something which would be relevant past this one's food. Does anyone have any thoughts on cases where that comes up, you know, in the world at large, in your own lives or your own experiences where you've encountered that?
It's like you see what you want to see. You hear what you want to hear. Like, there's that image that sometimes gets shown, and you can view it two different ways. You can view it as a young, pretty woman or an older woman. And the 10 spies viewed the land as a negative, whereas Joshua and Caleb viewed it as a positive.
What's he saying? A psychological illusion is similar in certain ways to an optical illusion.
Yeah, it's all about your own perspective and, like, what we talked about before, your faith and belief.
So could you give an example where that kind of perception might apply, you know, to us in, you know, in practical considerations, not just in, you know, test cases like the optical illusion? Do you have any thoughts of a kind of case that might come up?
Like deciding whether to take a new job or not, weighing positives and the negatives. It's, you might view it as a positive and you're really excited about it and see all the good aspects to it, but you tell your family, your parents, your friends about it, and they could have reservations for some other reasons that maybe you didn't think about, and they might try and dissuade you from accepting it.
And will their wanting to dissuade you necessarily be good advice, bad advice, something else?
It depends. Maybe your family wants you to take a job that would offer more money down the road. So they would dissuade you for that reason. So they think that they think they're providing good advice.
Right, so it could be meaning maybe they're making a mistake, maybe you are, but you're at least thinking on another perspective.
Right.
Okay. Any other thoughts of cases where this kind of thinking might come in handy?
You know, there's some people that their worldview, you know, colors the way they see things. So maybe I'm walking down the street and I didn't see you and I didn't smile. And then you have this worldview that people are negative. And so you may approach me and say, why were you mad at me? You just assumed I was mad or because I didn't acknowledge you or I didn't realize you were there, but your worldview or your mindset colored that it didn't occur to you that I didn't see you, or maybe, you know, she's thinking of something, but that's sort of the way you are in your thinking. So you automatically assumed it was anger, or whereas if you were maybe Joshua or Caleb, you would say, oh, she didn't see me. She maybe didn't see me, or she was off, you know, thinking about something. It just really depends where you're coming from and your worldview.
Absolutely. That's another good example. Right. I think Suzanne, you mentioned it might have been someone else. The example also of an HR department, right, where they give you the report where there's some good things and some bad things, the things to improve. You know, two people could sit through the exact same meeting, right, where each their own meeting, and are they only hearing the criticism, or are they hearing the room for growth, hearing the opportunities? So that'll come up in many different kinds of domains. Does anyone have any other thoughts of the kind of domains that might come up?
I was just thinking, I mean, it seems like it's all just coming down to, let's say, two people in the same situation, but just have different responses, right? That's kind of where we're going with this, just so I'm my understanding. So, I mean, there's the example of two people who are in separate cars stuck in the same traffic jam, and one of them is all upset, complaining, you know, maybe saying bad words, like, I just want to get home. And then the other person is sitting and, oh, you know what, let me use this time to relax. Let me put on the radio to a station I like. Let me just, you know, clear my head. And maybe, you know, once I get home, things are going to be crazy. So let me just, like, use this time. And it's all, you know, how you respond to a situation that, you know, could just be different, two different mindsets.
No, another excellent example. Right? So this is something which comes up all the time in terms of different, the lens that you're looking at the world will give an interpretation. And we only have a few minutes, but let's push this concept one step further, right? And pull it back around. You know, again, we mentioned this sin is something which is very central. We're already seeing it's something which is very central to all our lives. But the spies weren't only interpreting it for themselves. It wasn't only an internal question. Right. If now imagine ourselves not as the spies versus Caleb and Joshua, but the people are hearing, right, the people are listening to what the spies say versus Caleb and Joshua. And the people didn't see it themselves. They don't know what the facts of the matter are. All they have are the two sets of reports in which, on which to base whatever judgment they have. Now, part of that is, when you're listening to a report, we have to keep in mind that the person who's giving the report might just be telling us what they saw, you know, an actual factual, you know, testimony. And in this case, the spies did at the beginning. But they also might have a lot of their implicit premises feeding into what it is that they saw and what it is they thought they saw. And therefore, when it comes to listening to what people tell us, someone takes, to take an example, we mentioned Suzanne mentioned the example of someone passing you in the street and not saying hello. Right? Now you're a third party, and that person who wasn't greeted comes to you and says, so-and-so, is a horrible person, and, they were so unfriendly. Right? You didn't actually see the event. All you have is that person's interpretation. And if we talk about, again, we talk about slander, we talk about, which is a central issue when it comes to interpersonal things. It really can destroy relationships and destroy, destroy social harmony. That idea of recognizing not only that when I look at the world, I have to keep in mind, do I take a good outlook or a bad? But when I'm listening to what other people say, I have to interpret what they say through what lens might they be looking at it. Can I take what they say at face value, or do I need to take it with a grain of salt, would be an important correlate to the idea that people take everything based on their own personal lens. But it's much harder because we don't have the sense data immediately in front of us. All we have is the report, so that feels real. So that's an issue which I think is worth thinking about. Maybe we'll end with that idea, but taking this point of, the fact that people frame things in order to make them more believable, right? They start with the good and end with the bad. In terms of people do interpret things through their own lenses, now when it comes to us, taking it one step further, when it comes to us, not just our own lives, but in terms of listening to others or communicating with others, the next step would be how do these ideas impact on that realm? Does anyone have any thoughts or examples of that last phenomenon before we close for tonight? Oh, so maybe we'll end with that point, with that idea. And again, there's obviously more to the spy story. We didn't even read the whole story, but that key idea of what slander, what this is, and what it takes to either believe or not believe it. I'll leave you with that as something to consider and to apply. So, does anyone have any questions or comments on any other points in the shiur or otherwise before we end? So then what we'll do with that is at this point we will we'll call it, let's see if we can get this to work. So at this point we'll call it a night. Thank you for learning with me. I enjoyed it, and have a good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.